Hello and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. We can definitely say we're in the business end of the season now. Champions Cup knockouts gave us a couple of cracking games at the weekend and a few duds as well. Bernard Jackman and Johnny Murphy are here to talk through all of that. Later in the podcast, Hannah O'Connor will be back as the Women's Six Nations returns this weekend, Ireland hosting England in Cork on Saturday afternoon. Johnny, AIL season is wrapped up for the next few months. Naisi finished seventh in Division 1B. A season that could have gone better, could have gone worse, and you finished somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah, one of those years. We'd seven losing bonus points, and we were kind of in trying to push to win in all of those games, I suppose, bar the one where we lost to Trinity. But yeah, what could have been even this weekend, we had a chance at a drop goal in the last minute to win the game. So I'm just recovering after 2 days of I wouldn't say celebrating, but enjoying the lads' company over Saturday and Sunday. So, showing my age, I'm only getting back to normal on a Wednesday. But anyway, that's the way it goes.
And your family have you back on weekends now, yeah?
Yeah, back on weekends, yeah. Although racing might take over for the next couple of weeks, but don't tell my wife. It'll be fine. We'll figure it out.
Right, let's dive in on the Champions Cup. And Birch, I think there's only one place to start, over in La Rochelle. I've been thinking about this for the last couple of days. If you were getting AI to draw you up a famous monster European win, like just looking through all the ingredients from the weekend, an away knockout game where a surprising number of monster supporters managed to get tickets for not a particularly large stadium. A side narrative, like obviously Raj, but you could also have an old monster villain being involved. There always seems to be something like that. An awful start to the game. Give up an early try, early yellow card, and to be kind of on the ropes for the opening 10 or 15 minutes. An out half who has one of the best games of his career and throw in bonus points for a drop goal as well. Munster don't get a lot of chances in the match, but they take pretty much all of them. Their opposition fluff their lines constantly in attack. And then a late rally by the home side to set up a dramatic finale, and Munster see it through. It had everything you wanted. All the ingredients for a classic Munster Champions Cup win.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was great to see Munster back doing that in Europe. I hadn't realised it was that long since they'd won a big away game in France, because they've been involved in some belters over those years, but obviously coming out the wrong side of narrow losses, whereas this time they managed to close the deal. And yeah, the celebrations afterwards, the reconnection between the fans and the players, and as you said, the fans made an unbelievable effort. La Rochelle, I know this because it's one of those top 14 clubs that people struggle to get tickets to, even for top 14 games, and invariably get a message saying, "I'm heading to La Rochelle this weekend. It's sold out. Can you help?" So for Munster to be able to get that many tickets, we shouldn't be surprised, but every time they do it, it kind of does blow you away. I end up listening to the first half on the radio coming back to Croke Park, and on Michael Corcoran's coverage, some of the Munster decisions or moments, you would have thought, like, sometimes there was, before Corky could tell you what happened, you sensed it was a La Rochelle moment, or decision from a referee. But it was the Munster fans just making themselves heard. And then just typical, having to hang in at the end, and that drama at the end, go to the TMO, is it a high tackle, is it not, are La Rochelle going to have a penalty chance? And Munster didn't concede a penalty and got to win. And it's brilliant. It sets them up brilliantly for the end of the season. Obviously, they go to Bordeaux this weekend, and it's desperately hard for fans to get back down there, but knowing them, they'll make themselves heard again on Saturday, and they'll have seen enough in Bordeaux to believe they can win. I think Munster, just over the last 2 weeks, their ability to play cup rugby, even though the Connacht game in Mayo wasn't a cup match, they played like it was a cup match, and are just very tidy around those small momentum moments that decide cup games. So they feel really good about themselves.
And Johnny, like, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, like, the tournament and that round of 16, it needed a game like that, because like similar to Birch, I was on my way home from Croke Park that afternoon listening to the match on the radio, to Michael Corcoran's commentary. And like, we had sat through a 62-0 complete dud of a game, from aside from the opening 10 minutes maybe where Harlequins made a game of it. It was a complete dud of an 80 minutes. And to have that excitement listening to it on the radio on the way home, I was racing back from the Lewis stop to my home, which is about a 20 minute walk, trying to make sure I got in the door to even see the last like 5 or 10 minutes on the TV to just catch that drama. It was the game that the tournament desperately needed.
Yeah, and I think particularly with the week in it, in terms of a couple of teams saying, oh, look, we're targeting, you know, Saracens, like, who are, I suppose they're not so, but they're like, they were European powerhouse when you name the teams that have won it and how dominant they were for a number of years in the competition, having won it. When a team like that comes out and says, look, we're concentrating on the Premiership, and you look at, you know, how people have spoken about the tournament setup and all of that, it 100% did. And, you know, you look at, you know, some of the games then after that, it gives this round a bit of credibility. But then when you do look at particularly Croke Park, you kind of go, are we better off just going to another? But again, look, there's these conversations go on all the time around, particularly around this competition and what it is. And, you know, it was watching the highlight show on Sunday evening. I think everyone is really excited about this weekend. And like, to, you know, Mad said, like, this is the round that everyone loves, the quarterfinals. Mm. And historically, all of those big quarterfinal games, and there's some absolute mouth-watering ties. So it does kind of give you a bit of a want for what's going to be, you know, what the quarterfinal stage could throw up again.
As Bernard mentioned as well, like, it's been so long since Munster had won an away knockout game in France in the Champions Cup. I had it 23 years. It was the Cast win in 2002 semi-final was the last time Munster won a Champions Cup knockout game in France. They've lost to Biarritz twice since then. Both of those games were technically in Spain, but they were home games for Biarritz and just over the border. They were in San Sebastian. But you've Toulouse as well, Clermont, Toulon, Racing 92 as well. I was trying to jog back my memory of, like, this being the biggest Munster knockout win on the road since, I'm probably going back as far as the Harlequins game in 2013 at the Stoop. Mm. Were you playing in that one, Johnny?
Yeah, well, I wasn't playing with that. I was in the squad. Yeah, that one was, and that one came at a time where it was Rob's first year, and Rob was getting a load of flack around how we were playing. Rog was still there, so it was his first year, and it was just, remember Jimmy Downey, like, and it was his shot on
Mike Brown
that just won the game. I'll never forget how kind of emotional the day after the game Paulie got, because I was still classed as a bit of a younger player, how much flack we were getting, but how much work we were trying to put into a new system. Doug had been captain, and the night before we walked into our room, and he actually had a poem on our on all the seats, it was a warrior poem from New Zealand. It was incredible. Like, the whole weekend was just off the charts. But yeah, that was a real, real special one to be involved in. And yesterday, you see the scenes of the lads. On Sunday, the lads jumping into the squad with Zeebs and Nankyville and a couple of other guys that had travelled but weren't involved, kind of just shows what it means. And then all the stuff like with Golov on the teleporter and then on the bike with Dunners and Barry Murphy video. And it just kind of was one of those ones where it just seems to be that the connection seems to be back after, you know, Christmas time and everything. We're all kind of dogging them out a bit, and then when it comes around, you know, they pull this out of the bag. It was unbelievable to watch.
It was one of those days, Burners, where you were looking back going, God, I can't believe I was in Croke Park today.
Well, the press box, Neil, was pretty much empty. There wasn't many of us
and it was Baltic as well.
Baltic, yeah, there was no sun hitting it, and you couldn't watch the I my intention was to watch Munster in the press room there, but didn't have it on the TV, so that's why I had to jump in my car and I had to watch it back. But I don't know what it is about poems in pre-match, Johnny, because obviously that was part of the motivation. I was talking to Mick Quinn, the former Irish out half, on Saturday in Crow Park, and he told me a story about Moss Keane telling a poem.
That's me over the weekend.
Yeah, telling a poem. So basically, they were playing England and Twickenham back in the day, and they were massive underdogs, and everyone was very nervous. And Mossy got up the front of the bus and he said, "Lads, can I, I've written a poem about today. Can I say it?" The lads said, "Yeah, grand." So the poem was four lines. It was, "Am I lucky to be an Irishman? Am I lucky to be born free? I wish I was a puppy dog and England were a tree." And they all got off the bus, absolutely breaking their holes laughing, and went out and beat England 3 tries to 1. So I don't know, Neil, if you can ease that in, but if you want. But it's just funny. Apparently, the whole bus just relaxed and they went out and won. So it just came into my mind when you said about the poem from Dougie. But it's Munster. When Munster have had their great days, you'd often find that there has been a couple of things emotionally that's led to that. And obviously, look at, you know, the Raj factor, you know, maybe some of the comments from Raj in the past about Munster or even, you know, whatever it was, the point to prove from some of those players who haven't been playing for Ireland. Like Gav Coombs now is, like, his record is in try scoring. You know, for a 27-year-old, it's insane. You know, and he had a big game, and that's what those lads need to do is have big games against really good opposition when there's lots at stake. And in fairness to Farrell trusts the Leinster players because they haven't let him down when they play for Ireland. But Munster, the only way to change that is to go and actually have more games like Saturday. And I thought they showed an unbelievable amount of courage, skill, spirit, you know, the ability to stand toe-to-toe with that La Rochelle pack was something I didn't know that they'd be able to do it over 80 minutes. And, you know, at times they're under pressure, the Maul try for the penalty try and the Sim Binning, you know, probably was a pretty harsh decision on Kildallan for sure. But in general, they stood up very, very well to La Rochelle, and the halfbacks were brilliant. And to do it without Nankivell, I think is massive and interesting. They're appealing decision, so they may get him back for Bordeaux. I think it would be a big boost for him to get him back for Bordeaux if they can manage to get that back to one game suspension. But like given the season the way it's gone, like highs and lows, obviously difficult with pre-Christmas and Graham leaving, and then, you know, even at Edinburgh resulting performance in Cork, but to pick themselves up for what was a historic win for them is brilliant.
And it just like in particular, like, just name check two guys that kind of epitomised everything you just said there, Birch. Like, their two wingers were off the charts, not just in attack, but defensively. Like, you know, you look at kind of Andrew Smith, his chasing at the breakdown. I know he gets a yellow card, but, like, I think that's a bit of a harsh penalty when he gets done. Like, he's first man in, okay, but, like, he's on the ball. His work rate off for when Thomas kind of brains that one on the edge to get around, put a passer under pressure. Calvin Nash, the first moment after halftime, they go up, their kickoff, they contest the kickoff, he gets the turnover, they get a penalty straight away. And then within the Thomas incident, when he goes back inside, Calvin Nash works again in behind. So the two wingers are working off their wing, doesn't require any talent, just pure doggedness, and he's the one there that holds up the La Rochelle player over the line. 2 minutes later, Coombs gets the block down try. So, like, those swings and momentums that those two individuals gave, and just out of pure want, was like that for me. And as a past player, I was like, that was unbelievable to see.
And on that incident, the the Teddy Thoma butchered try. And I think it was Oscar Jaegu that Calvin Nash put into to touch eventually, though. As we were pointing out, obviously didn't see it, the match live in the moment. It wasn't until Monday morning where I had a chance to actually sit down and watch it from start to finish. And it was incredible watching that sequence of play back, knowing obviously that La Rochelle don't score a try, because for 2 minutes I'm watching phase after phase and I'm going, how don't they score here? Like, how the pass goes out to Teddy Thoma out on the wing and you see Ollie Yeager and Josh Witcherly chasing him down. And I'm going, how does this not end in a try, Bernard? In fairness, like, top marks to Munster's defence and scrambling, and to Yeager and Witcherly in that case as well for hounding him down and chasing down lost causes. But my God, some of the butchering of attacks from La Rochelle was staggering.
Yeah, I look at that's Teddy Thoma in a nutshell. He could do amazing things, and that's why.
Because he ripped them apart in the first half.
He's absolutely gifted. But Galtier has decided, you know, I can't get this guy on track. I can't say. Look, it's very hard to say. He's not going to fulfill his talent because he has already accumulated some amazing moments, and obviously he's a highly successful player. But that brain fart from him is kind of sums him up to a certain extent as well, and makes him very frustrating, I think, to be a teammate of. Now, in fairness to Munster, credit their scramble, and even from the moment he steps back inside, they still have a lot to do to stop it. But I think when something like that happens, it does give you belief that it's your day. And also, when you're a team like La Rochelle, who have been just struggling for wins, that can actually be another knock to your confidence. And it's definitely for Rog. Rog was very, very good after the match speaking about it. But it was one of those moments where they reviewed the game on Monday and they went, how do we not, you know, take advantage here? And obviously, as you said, they had a fast start as well. But just couldn't land the killer blow, and the longer you let Munster live, the more dangerous it is, and La Rochelle got caught.
It was it was incredible. You mentioned some of the individuals who stood out, Johnny Calvin Nash and Andrew Smith as well, but like, when you run through the team sheet, you could probably pick 10-11 players out of that starting 15 that probably had their best match of the season at the weekend, and that's what it took. Like I mentioned Ollie Yeager there. I thought that was the best he's looked since he joined Munster, to be totally honest. Josh Witcherly had to play 65-70 minutes off the bench coming in for Jeremy Lockman, who picked up an injury as well and looked absolutely gassed, the poor fella, at the end of the game. He was dying with his boots on. Tyke Byrne, outrageous, going after the breakdown all afternoon. We mentioned Jack Crowley and Craig Casey, the two wingers in on top of it as well. Like, it took a staggering amount of effort to hold off La Rochelle.
Yeah, and I think you look at, for me, you can look at one incident in the game that everyone knew. I think that drop goal is a set play off a scrum. Crowley never engages. If you watch him throughout every phase, people come around the corner for their three phases, he never engages open side. He's always hovering back in behind the ruck or just to the left-hand side. And you look at Murr's pass, like, he doesn't look anywhere else off that ruck. He goes straight behind instantly. So everyone was bang on there. Like, coming around the corner, 1-15, did exactly what they were asked to do in that set play. They hit the rucks. And it was like big balls to call it, because it's fair, like, it's outside the 10 meter. So when you're outside the 10 meter, you have to get you have to kick it. So your accuracy can kind of wane a small bit when you're trying to make sure that you have enough to get there. But I think that's a set play just in terms of, and particularly the last one, it's just so clear. Murr's just straight back and Craig just knocks it over. But it's like, The clarity in everyone's role, your clear mindset to call that in that position, still with 10 minutes to go. Like, there's a lot to go in the game, but to just get that buffer of the 8 points and then just to be accurate enough to knock it over was class.
Crowley's had a big 2 weeks. Coming out of the Six Nations, where obviously he would have been frustrated with his lack of game time. The best way to answer is is keep your head down and play well. And he's done more than that. Brilliant up in McHale Park with Casey. And again, down in La Rochelle, both of them were outstanding. And Casey in particular, his box kicking, just had La Rochelle really struggling for possession because of the accuracy and the quality of the kick chase, but starts with the accuracy of kick. And it's great for Munster to have two homegrown halfbacks who are just probably in the peak of their form, which is ideal coming into the last couple of months of the season.
Yeah, and I do think that's something like, say, how Harlequins played does potentially put Jack Crowley back in a selection contest against someone like Marcus Smith for that kind of third choice 10, because he covers 15 and he covers three or four different positions. That, you know, how Quinn's kind of headed for the gate, and like what Farrell and his coaching staff are looking for guys that will kind of really push through that, the difficulty rather than lying down. It does, I'm not sure he'll go, but it does, when you look at a like for like in terms of your third choice 10 potentially covering two or three different positions rather than having to bring three out and out 10s. I think that's that the last 2 weeks have been really, really good for Crowley.
Craig Casey's entered that conversation, has he, in the last couple of weeks? He's knocking on the door at least.
Yeah, because obviously we look at the fact that he missed the Six Nations, you would have thought that ruled him out, and Ireland have two nines. But the fact that Munster now get another week at least, and maybe more, another opportunity to go, away from home against a star-studded side, against Luku, and show what he can do, is exactly what he needs. Exactly what he needs. Like you could argue that Ireland are the Irish nines, both could go, because obviously they know how Farrell wants to play, and also, to be honest, like there's not a lot like of the other nines. I could see two Irish nines, to be fair. Yeah. If Casey gets another shot this weekend and has a big game, Alex Mitchell is good. Thomas Williams is good. It's definitely an opening for him there, particularly if they could win this weekend and he has another big game.
Well, let's talk about this weekend then. And I suppose a bit of last weekend with Bordeaux and Ulster, obviously, as well. It feels like a shame that Munster have to go back and do it all again this week. Like, as I said, it had been 23 years since they won a knockout game in France, and now they have to do it twice in the space of 7 days. This short turnaround between round of 16 and quarterfinals was an issue last year, when we had the Bulls sending a second string to Northampton in the quarters, La Rochelle just being absolutely jaded after they got back from South Africa. But look, I think you said it at the top of the podcast, Bernard, that like in the last couple of years, Munster have been in this situation before. They've had their trips down to South Africa. They went on the run to win the URC, and a very improbable run to win the URC title 2 years ago. They went on a big run this time last year as well, which ultimately didn't end in the title. But it shows that like they are a very streaky team. They're a momentum team.
Yeah, they are. And I know that their waveform hadn't been great up till Connacht or whatever, but they can kind of thrive in that touring type mindset. And obviously they've got to go back to France. Bordeaux is a special stadium. But more importantly for Munster, like, to be fair, when they scouted La Rochelle, they would have seen lots of things, particularly the results that gave them hope. You know what I mean? And now, likewise, Bordeaux were top seeds based on how impressive they were in the group stages. But to be fair to them, I watched them against Racing a couple of weeks ago away. Very average. Against Ulster, while some of their play was exceptional, they were also incredibly loose, and Ulster gave them a huge amount of problems, and they look tired. I thought they looked tired, and obviously sometimes teams, when they go from not having many internationals to having lots of internationals, and I think La Rochelle probably suffered from this on the other side of it, it does take take a while for people to adjust to that. That not just physically, emotionally. You know what I mean? Emotionally playing another five games in front of big crowds with a lot of stakes. So, and the other issue for Bordeaux is their four pack doesn't in any way match up to their backs. You know. No. And again, have you ever seen? I haven't seen a team as imbalanced as Bordeaux win a Champions Cup. I haven't seen a team as imbalanced as them win a Champions Cup. Now maybe they'll be the first. But seeing them over the last few weeks, I'm starting to have big doubts that they're ready. Even Toulouse without Capuazzo and Dupont, they still have enough up front. I think that they're genuine contenders. Toulon are coming. Are coming on a bit of a run as well. And obviously, one of them are going to knock each other out this weekend. It's going to be a cracking game. Like the challenge is, look, it's very hard. It's desperately hard for Munster to go back to France a week later. But that's unfortunately the current model, and there's lots of faults with it. And I don't agree with the way it runs. But seeding is massive, and Bordeaux top seed. Leinster were poxed that they finished second seed, but actually got the best draw. You know, it's just the way it worked out. Like, if you looked at Leinster seed and Leinster's draw and you didn't know what they were, you would have said they were top seed. With obviously Toulouse and Toulon and Bordeaux and La Rochelle and Munster, etc., down the other side. So, it is what it is. I think they'll revel in it. And as I said, then when they scouted Bordeaux, particularly the Ulster game, they will have seen so many opportunities, particularly around the breakdown. I know. Defensively, Ulster caused a lot of damage. But that breakdown isn't anywhere near as clean as it needs to be against a team like Munster, who are technically so good there. And I think they'll be incredibly excited. And I wouldn't be shocked if they pulled off a win, honestly. I think they have big momentum. And Bordeaux are just starting to run on fumes a little bit, it looks like.
Yeah. And they kept giving Ulster opportunities this weekend. Even you look at the last play, like, you know, I written in my notes going through it, like Ulster were really unlucky at the end there with that knock on to be within a score to play in the last 2 minutes. Like, you know, where you look at the first kind of 30 minutes, 20 minutes, and it's 21-0 and you're going, oh, Jesus. But like Ulster really stuck in that. They fought, they played some really good rugby and they kept going and they nearly got their like just reward, which was an opportunity in the last 2 minutes to go and win it, you know, and like I think that's like that will give you know that will give Munster a huge huge energy driver that they can go and do it, you know. But I thought Ulster were really good after their first 20 minutes just to kind of keep going, because you know we've given them a load of crap before about sometimes they've laid down over, you know, the last number of months. They didn't at all. Like, okay, as I said, Bordeaux gave them opportunities, but Ulster took them, you know, and they went after him. And it was just really disappointing when they went back to the TMO that there wasn't that opportunity for them, you know.
Well, on another day, like as you mentioned, Johnny, Ulster almost had it down to a one score game in the last couple of minutes. But you look at just before half time, and having come from 21-0 down, they got it back to 21-14. They're coming down right into the final seconds of that first half, Birch, and I can't remember which Ulster player it was, but there's 15, 20 seconds left and they just, they kick a little bit too long down into the Bordeaux backfield. And you were thinking, even in the moment, you're thinking, oh, you probably should have just been trying to hold on to that for another three or four phases. I know it's tough and it's hot and all that, but like, just get into the halftime break, 7 points behind, who knows? And all of a sudden Bordeaux, just rip them open, score a try. It's a 14-point game at halftime. And it was never really alive the Ulster comeback was never really alive from then on.
No. And in fairness, that's another thing. Like, Munster tend not to kick as loosely as Ulster. You know, Munster's kicking game is very rigid. They kick to contest more often than they're not. And they do contest. And they're... the likelihood of getting hurt on those contestables is far less than kicking long against Bordeaux. And I think, again, you know, the couple of tries that Bordeaux got from counterattack is a perfect reminder and warning to be so careful kicking long. And likewise for Bordeaux now, if Abraham comes back, you're going to see him as a threat, you know. And to be honest, their kick chase is very lethargic at times. You know, Munster... Munster could see opportunities to go back. And I think Munster's counter-attack game is a big weapon for them, especially in phase play, especially after the first phase. But now with Abrahams have a chance to maybe hurt them on first phase in particular. Obviously, they've got a great back three, but he just has that those dancing feet that you want bringing it back. So, Bordeaux will have to be so careful kicking out to Munster. And this game mightn't be a 40-30 point match. This could be an old-fashioned, Champions Cup game with maybe under 40 points in total. And if it is, Munster will have a hell of a chance.
Yeah, I wrote down in my notes looking at it. I was like, you look at their try just before halftime, there was very few rooks. Like, it was off.
Yeah.
It was offload. I wrote down in my notes, if you can, for Bordeaux, if you can stop their transition attack and their counter attack by good kick chase and just being kind of boring in that space, get up, do your basics well, and then get them into rooks, like make them rook, then you have a real chance. Because you look at what Munster did this weekend with Byrne and the wingers, we've already spoke about that. If you can get them into a rooking game where you're stopping their offloads and you're slowing them down just by being not bored, well, yeah, like old school, boring, making them have in a multi-phase, make them have, try and get them to have 20, 25 rooks, they'll struggle. Where if you allow them offload, if they can get 5 or 6 offloads away in one phase, that's where you're under pressure because your defensive line is going back. But I think their kicking game, they'll struggle against Munster if Munster have a really accurate kick and test game there, because there just won't be space.
That's the key. So just make it really, really boring. And I don't think any Munster fan would complain about that whatsoever. Final word on this match. Actually, I will point out as well, because we haven't mentioned him, Louis Biaberi will be back for Bordeaux this week. That obviously changes things. But final point in this game, from an Ulster point of view, Bernard, I'm always wary of it being maybe a little bit patronising to teams in defeat. But if you are going to lose a game like that, from an Ulster point of view, where they are at the moment, they'll have taken an enormous amount out of this weekend.
Yeah, no, they will, because they'll just see progress. Progress from where they were early on when they obviously played Bordeaux and Toulouse in the group stages. And they weren't really, like, I would have, this is harsh, but I would have said they didn't really deserve to be on the same pitch as them, in terms of contenders for anything. Whereas leaving the ground on Sunday, they would have felt, yeah, we can live with these fellas. We went after them. And as Johnny said, probably unlucky not to go into the last couple of minutes where Bordeaux have a kickoff that they're shitting themselves, because Toulouse or Ulster have shown the capacity to go from deep and they're playing with a lot of confidence and their attacking game was excellent. So I think Ulster made big strides. McNabney's been an unbelievable find. Zach Ward's been another one. Just on Zach Ward and Andrew Smith, and also it's relevant to the women's as well, is I'm not a massive believer that sevens makes you a better 15s player, but what it is very good for is getting you used to being able to perform in front of big crowds and under pressure. And like, so if you think of a sevens tournament where you play 3 games a day, you play, you cool down, you warm up again, you've got a very small window to execute, so you have to be on. And I think that, you're looking at the Irish women's team as well and the lack of experience they have in terms of international 15s caps. Yes, those sevens players, they haven't battled an eyelid, basically. They've just come into big pressure games of 15s and performed. And likewise, Zach Ward, Andrew Smith are examples of that. Like Andrew Smith and Zach Ward, they must have questioned over the last couple of years, was there a career for them in rugby union, and yet now both of them have played in massive European last 16 games against 2 star-studded teams with lots at stake and acquitted themselves incredibly well. And Zach Ward in particular, because obviously he's a little bit newer to the whole thing, he's given what Ireland are probably going to lose Mac and James Lowe to the Lions. He's probably someone that they're going to have a look at over the summer tour, I would say.
Mm. And Jacob Stockdale on top of that as well.
Yeah, obviously
continuing his great form. Leinster 62, Harlequins 0. 10 tries for Leinster. Bernard Harlequins came to Dublin. They played for 10 minutes. They had a crack. They got nowhere with it. And then they just kind of raised the white flag.
Yeah, the first attacking sequence was excellent. Like they're a sharp set piece on top of Leinster. Took some big scramble. Eventually, Leinster held them up over the line and a goal line dropout. And from there, they basically didn't fire a shot, really. You know, they looked completely ill at ease with how to attack Leinster. And it was very difficult for Danny Wilson, their head coach, because his last time playing against Leinster, I remember meeting him in the RDS.
Yeah,
and Glasgow, do you remember? And it cost him his job. I can't remember what the exact score was, but it was an absolute
It was like 70-something, 12 or something like that.
Yeah, and I felt brutal because before the match, we were chatting to him and he was telling me his kids were, you know, really settled in Glasgow and loved it and all that stuff. And then obviously the game went the way it went. And then, a little while later, they parted ways. And I remember leaving the ground going, geez, I hope he doesn't lose his job over that result. And I'm not saying he's going to lose his job over Croke Park, but like that kind of result can actually really affect confidence in the program, you know, and confidence with the board, confidence with the fans. They're having an up and down, mainly down Premiership season. The issue is Danny's a very pragmatic coach, and it's not really Quinn's way. And if you remember what happened with Gustard, he tried to bring in the Saracens model to Harlequins. There was a player revolt, and they effectively coached themselves at the end of that season and actually won a premiership. Like, the most unlikely premiership of all time, but they won it. I don't know if you can play Harlem Globetrotters rugby against Leinster and expect to win, but also I don't think you can be as dull as they were and expect to do anything either. So there's something in between. But to be fair, I have to say for Harlequins, they ran into a Leinster team where there was a little bit of bite there. Leinster potentially would benefit from the fact that they weren't successful in the Six Nations, in that these players now have absolutely one job on their mind, which is to win for Leinster. And they also obviously have a playing system that's incredibly consistent. Obviously, only lost one game this year. They have the best team. They have the best squad. With Capuazzo and DuPont injured, there's no 23 that you would swap for them, I don't think, left of the competition. And obviously, with home quarterfinal, home semifinal, if they win that, if they don't win it this year, serious questions has to be asked.
I checked that Glasgow 76-14.
Okay.
That was the score on that.
It was bleak.
Johnny, Bernard mentioned there, like, Leinster's attack looked really, really fluid on Saturday. Way more slick than it has been for a while, probably all season as well. How much can we actually read into that, considering everything we've just said about Harlequins? I did find it interesting that Leo Cullen, after the game, seemed pretty pleased. And from speaking to him over the years, he will normally play it very, very straight-faced. He will actually probably, after games like that in the past, he has a tendency to kind of pick out three or four bad things that, you know, three or four things that went wrong and kind of deflect away from running up a big score. But I did notice he was particularly pleased with how that attack hummed on Saturday.
Yeah, I think you look at, for me, their green zone attack, so in opposition 22, their options are not just forwards. So their centres that are popping up outside forwards, which are giving forwards opportunity to fill their lungs and get around the corner. I think how fluid they are in their movement in between the 10 metres when they're playing multi-phases off the charts. Like, if you go through every game, they run a Brumbies or a Sexton loop, but there's different people in each one. So I think for Ringrose plays, they play a Brumbies play. Conan gets the ball and Tyke Furlong runs short and it goes out the back to James Lowe. That's in the middle of the pitch. So James Lowe is off his wing in the middle of the pitch with an eight and a prop who run a Brumbies play out the back. He passes to Van der Fleer, who plays like he's a 13 at the weekend in the 15. Real, like, his accuracy of pass there was unbelievable. And then Ringrose, or 13, finishes it. But they have stuff like that in pretty, obviously, the Mall tries, but how they get in It's their multiple options on the ball that everyone is always, and the ability for every player, 1 to 15, to run those multi-phase plays and then be accurate. I just thought it was off the charts. Now, it was a team run towards the last 35, 40 minutes in reality, but like, everyone was in the right place and everyone was an option. You know, like, even if Conan plays furlong short there, he'll still get an outside shoulder and potentially get an offload. You know, like, so it's that's what I was most impressed with. And they never stopped. They kept going the whole way to the end.
To be fair, normally I'd be worried about a blowout like that in terms of the danger it could present for next week. Or it's not a real reflection of what it takes to win European Cup games. But I think the only reason I'm not worried about it is because Leinster have had a lot of kind of dour, tough games already this year. You know, so they've shown themselves to be quite good in tight situations as well, and so I think they've lots of that in their locker. That their game management is good, and actually they actually probably needed a blowout like that, because it just gives them confidence that their attack can actually hurt teams as well. So probably timing wise, normally I wouldn't. There's no need to be beating teams that much in a knockout game, particularly when you have another one the week after, because you can't. You can't mess up. You have to be on. But I think they're around long enough to realize that Quinn's match isn't reflective of what it takes to be a Champions Cup team. And Glasgow, while it's a match day, obviously should win. It's a totally different challenge. But Glasgow have a lot more about them. They have a lot more bite than Quinn's.
But I wouldn't underestimate what that win in South Africa with half the team did for the whole group. Like, I remember we got to 3 finals 1 year in Leicester, and he literally sent, and Leo was actually captain, can't say what we called ourselves, but Leo was captain of that second team in Leicester at the time. And we got sent up to Edgley Park to play in, to play Sale in Jason Robinson's last ever home game. And like, it was a team of 21-year-olds and Leon Lloyd. And Leo and Leon Lloyd kicked the absolute shit out of Shabal for the whole afternoon. And we ended up winning by, I think, 4 or 5 points. It was unbelievable. It was one of the best wins I've ever been involved in. But we came back after a massive bus journey. And it was like, that week in training was so cool, because the lads who hadn't played were like so proud of us. And we were like, well, we've done this. We can play in a European semi or final here now, because we've done that ADF final as it was then, because we played that well. If there's an injury, Paddy will pick us, like, you know. So like, I wouldn't underestimate what that win does for the group and the belief within the group, and keeping everyone happy as well. Like, that's a big thing going into this last, you know, the last 8 weeks of the season.
I think that is a big thing as well, Johnny. And it was something Josh van der Vlier mentioned a couple of times after the match as well. Number one, because it's just the sheer belief it gives you and all that sort of stuff as well. But also there was the element that he kind of said that there's almost a sense of responsibility on the Leinster players going out against Harlequins at the weekend, that the rest of that crew went to South Africa, so you didn't have to. And so you had the best opportunity in the best 2 weeks to prepare for this Champions Cup match. And that responsibility meant that, you know, you're not going to let those players down for doing it, which I think is very important. And just the general good feeling it's brought around the place. You saw how the season trickled off last year and the year before, all after that South Africa game when things didn't really seem right. One last bit on Harlequins I do want to mention. Like, after the game, Danny Wilson in the press conference starts bringing up the budget issue again. And we've been here and talking about how are we supposed to compete and stuff. I did find that tough to take, Bernard, when you could see, go back and look at Leinster's second try. When the game is in the balance, there's a quarter of an hour into the game, and Sam Prendergast puts a little chip over the top in the 22, and three Harlequins players jog past it and weren't interested in diving down on the ball. I just found, I think, talk about budgets and talk about how difficult it is for other teams and how there's an imbalance out there. If you lose 45-19 and you fired a few shots and you just got overwhelmed, but too much of that game Harlequins just seemed disinterested in, and I'm not really sure where a budget comes into that.
No, in fairness, he's trying to deflect there, but that's not his biggest issue was his own player's application. And it was interesting because he'd been very critical of Saracens deciding to rotate for the Toulon game. And I believe, okay, well, Quins are coming here locked in. They respect this competition and they're gonna play like that. There's no doubt the budget Leinster have, like he one of his comments was, they have an All Black on the bench, and that's true. But it had very little to do with actually the context of that game in terms of the Gulf in class. There shouldn't be anywhere near that Gulf in class. Even Sarries went to Toulon, and it was only the last quarter where, Toulon's power and experience and first choice team told, whereas Quins were dead after 20 minutes, and that's more he needs to look inwards. But obviously he realizes that if he had done that in the press conference, it would have been hard to reverse your way out of it without causing damage to yourself. So no, the budget isn't, and it's going to become less relevant now as we get towards the last four in particular.
Mm-hmm. The while you mentioned it, the Toulon Saracen scoreline is just incredible. What was it, 74-42 or something? I was saying it's like it's the scoreline you get on day three of a junior rugby tour, where both both teams have been on it for a couple of days, and it's all just a bit loose. You know, you don't see 70-something, 40-something in professional rugby that much.
Yeah,
on Connacht, Racing 92 this Saturday evening, a 35-20 win against Cardiff. Cardiff have their own problems now going into administration. We might briefly mention that at the end. But for Connacht, Johnny scored some lovely tries again. You do just have this worry that teams aren't having to work hard enough for their scores when they're playing against Connacht.
Yeah, like I kind of thought the scoreline probably wasn't really effective how close the game was. Like Cardiff got into full flow a couple of times. They're a great team to watch. But unfortunately they just kind of struggled to kind of get over the line sometimes. But Cardiff are a very good attacking team. I think Cardiff's first try and their multi-phase was a really class try, but they just kind of their defense can be opened up a bit too easily at times. But again, good confidence, a 60, so they go into thing. But it was a really good game to watch. I think Devine again played very well. Bolton's finish off that first phase try from Ioane was excellent. Ioane again, just his pace just gives you that in, particularly in any of those wraps where you've first phase opportunities. But a tighter game than the scoreline would have suggested, in my opinion.
Johnny mentioned Matthew Devine there, actually, Bernard, and Ireland's scrum half stocks are in relatively healthy place at the moment. Never mind Ireland, Connacht's scrum half stocks, because he's Caelan Blade and the forgotten man of the last 6 weeks, Ben Murphy, who was unbelievable.
I think he's back.
What was it, a broken thumb or something like that. So they have a very, very healthy collection of scrum halves there.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to see how it all plays out in terms of pecking order. Devine has been, they've been quite slow to give Devine consistent game time, but he's a lot about him, and probably suits the way Connor play. Like, he's wild, and he gives him something really different. And obviously Murphy was brilliant for him at the start of the season because of his tempo and his quality of his pass. Devine's pass isn't at the same level, but he's probably more, he is definitely more of a danger around the fringes, and his ability to make breaks himself. And then obviously Caelan Blade has been a credible servant to Connacht and never lets him down. So Devine is the selection for this week. Just my understanding is Racing are coming with the Espoirs or very close to it. Now it's not confirmed, but I spoke to someone attached to Racing last night trying to get a heads up, and he said the feeling from the club was that they would prioritize next week's top 14 game. over this, but he's going to, supposed to come back to me this morning for this pod, but he hasn't. Even though they're an hour ahead, he's let me down. He's probably having a tobacco, and a coffee. But yeah, I don't think they're coming fully loaded. I think they went to Perpignan strongish because
yeah,
you know, you don't want to go 2 weeks in a row. And they obviously they've turned the corner a little bit in the top 14. Collazo's been brought in there to save them. Now maybe they'll do a U-turn and want to chase this, but my understanding is that they're not coming fully loaded, and that would give Connacht a hell of a chance, because they're not fully loaded on the pitch, but they're not fully committed mindset wise. You know, it'll be easy, but obviously, like, them not coming fully loaded player wise, but coming fully loaded mindset wise would be dangerous for Connacht, because they're such a good squad. So it'll be interesting, but it would be great if they could get a semi-final. Because obviously, because they're seeding, they'll be home in that as well. And who knows from there?
Exactly. And who knows even where that could be played? You know, yeah. They might be able to move that to a larger stadium. They're in the middle of building a stadium at the moment. These things cost money. Every extra home game, Johnny, I imagine that you can get is going to be a very, very important one, let alone the opportunity to try and push for a trophy, which kind of, you know what, they got to a URC semi-final where they came close against the Stormers a couple of years ago. But since they won the old Pro 12 back in 2016, they haven't really had a sniff at repeating that bit of silverware. And look, I know there's a long way to go in this tournament. They'd have to beat Racing this weekend. What, Leon or Ospreys in a semi-final? And then you're probably talking someone quite difficult, maybe a Bath or something like that in a final. But, you know, it would be a lovely thing for these supporters to be able to go on a run and start dreaming about a bit of silverware again.
Oh yeah, massively. And like that revenue thing, I think that is a downfall with the opportunity not to be able to move it to a new stadium, playing the likes of Racing. Like, you can market it yeah, as, you know, a Galacticos, you know, whether they bring them or not is, you know, that's down to selection. But there's a lot in that, and it would be great to see them go on a run. Where would the semi-final be? Are they away, or do they?
It would be home. No,
they're home, aren't they? But they can move it within the province, can they, or in the country? It's in Ireland.
It can be at the Dexcom, yeah, if they want. It's not like the Champions Cup where you're talking about, you know, home but not home stadium kind, sure, of a thing. It can be the Dexcom if they want it to be as well.
It'd be massive for them to go on a run, and it'd be brilliant for it'd be brilliant for the supporters to get that opportunity. What is this coming up on? 9 years, is it? 9 years or
10? 9 years.
9 years. So it'd be great for them to emulate that.
Final point then, Bernard. We mentioned it when we mentioned Cardiff, but the worrying news yesterday that Cardiff they're going to be going into administration. They're not quite in it yet. They're in the process of going into administration. They served their notice of intent yesterday. As it stands, they're not gone out of business. They still will be playing matches and seeing out the season. But I suppose there is the uncertainty of what happens. The reports are saying that the Welsh Rugby Union are going to step in and ultimately take control. But, like, even if they do survive, it is just another worrying story for the game as a whole, but especially in Wales.
Yeah, look, there's not a week goes by without some kind of crisis in Welsh rugby, and this is another one. I think that the WRU long term will end up with three regions, and if this was one of the other regions, if this was Dragons or Ospreys, they might let them fold. I think Scarlets, because of the geographical position in West Wales, and obviously Cardiff being the capital city, they wouldn't want either of those to go. It came at the 11th hour the last time, I think in 2017, they stepped in to save the Dragons, who were going to go into administration and probably receivership. But they bought, by taking them over, they actually got the land. They got Rodney Parade, so there was some kind of value. There's actually nothing really associated with Cardiff Rugby Club owned very little. The ground is owned by Cardiff Athletics Club. So you're really not buying anything bar the club, but obviously at the WRU, they need to have a club.
They can't let Cardiff.
And also, to be honest, they're in bed together because of the stadium and the fact that the back of the stadium, they share They share facilities there, etc. So they'll end up taking them over. Players, hopefully, and staff, they've over 100 employees. Hopefully, they'll be secure for a while, and at least until things settle down. But, like, they brought in... So Peter Thomas was the benefactor there. Peter's Pies, millionaire from Pies. And I think he lost or put in... He wrote off 13 million during his time there. Like, an unbelievable benefactor. Loved the club. And what a historic club it is. No club has produced as many British and Irish Lions as Cardiff RFC. And, you know, they've been getting better crowds than ever. But it just shows you how difficult it is to make money or break even at a pro rugby. And ironically, this morning I was reading in the French newspaper that the Rugby World Cup in France has lost the FFR at least 19 million. But their fear is it'll be 29 million by the time all the court cases are settled. And that was, like, for those of us who were there, and lots of Irish people were there, that was an incredibly successful World Cup in terms of attendances, in terms of, like, marquee sponsorship, off-field merchandise. I would have thought were all good. And yes, the FFR, now the World Rugby got their cut, they were guaranteed their cut, but the FFR are probably looking at a loss of around 25 million. The worst case scenario is 29 million. Like, it's very hard to make money in pro rugby at the moment.
Yeah, worrying times. I'm sure we'll find out more about what's happening with Cardiff as the days and weeks going on. Bernard, thanks a million. Johnny, thank you as well. I'd say thank you to a man called Jason as well. I met him on the Lewis coming home from Croke Park on Saturday afternoon. Always listens to the pod every week. Big fan of Bernard Jackman and of Johnny Murphy and Johnny Holland as well. Never misses an episode, and he was it was lovely to chat to him. Jason from County Louth, so I said I'd give him a good old shout out. More coming on the podcast this week, talking Women's Six Nations with Hannah O'Connor. Now, the Guinness Women's Six Nations returns this week after a break. Ireland against England is this Saturday, 4:45 p.m. on RTE2 and RTE Player. Hannah O'Connor is back with me again this afternoon. Hannah, how are you?
I'm good, Neil. Thanks for having me back.
All roads lead to Cork this weekend, Virgin Media Park, Saturday afternoon. The IRFU actually said earlier this week they're looking to kind of push on and break that Women's Six Nations attendance record in Ireland. They kind of did it a couple of times last year at the RDS, and then the final game against Scotland up in Belfast, where 7,468 was the mark they had in Belfast last year. So they're hoping to push it down in Cork this weekend. And I suppose that might be the place to jump in this week. Musgrave Park holds just over 8,000. That would be the mark they're trying to get. It'd be close to a sellout if they can. But obviously, like, when Ireland and England met last year, just under 50,000 were at Twickenham. So this is, you know, this is small fry compared to that. But I was curious to get your sense. Like, do you get the sense that the interest is growing in women's rugby in Ireland, that the public is getting behind the game more and more? And I know, like, we're taking small steps, obviously, with these attendance records bit by bit, but you have to take those small steps, I suppose, at the end of the
day. Yeah, 100%. It has to start somewhere. And I know me and you have chatted about over the last few weeks of, like, the popularity that's growing with the women's game and the publicity that the game is getting off the back of what the girls did last year in the Six Nations and qualifying for the World Cup. But then being able to kind of take the momentum that brought with it and then roll into the WXV competition, where they're underdogs, expected to get bet out the gate by many, you know, but to really put a stamp on things over there and to bring that momentum back to the kind of the home soil of having those games at home, I think they really capitalized on the momentum that's there. And yeah, I do think that the interest is growing massively. And you said those little incremental games of creeping attendances up and up and up. I think the style of rugby that the girls are playing is a really attractive brand of rugby. The players that they have, you know, you're paying in the gate to see these type of players, the likes of your Niamh O'Dowd, the likes of your Aoife Wafers, Aoife Daltons, all of these players that are, you know, all of a sudden a household name on many girls' lips. That's what we've wanted all along, is to grow the game in that nature. Yes, we are behind our counterparts from across the pond. But as you said, it has to start somewhere. And I think Cork has been an incredible place to go to over the last few years, despite it feeling like it might be further away. And there's always the cribbing and the moaning from some people, as in dragging people down to Cork, up to Belfast. But I think it's been brilliant. I think that element of spreading the women's game around the country has helped towards that growth. I think we always get a ridiculously warm welcome down in Cork. the people, whether it's staying in the hotel that you'd be in the team hotel or just out and about getting coffees, the people down there are just a different kettle of fish. And you have, as I said, the likes of the Enya Breens and the other Cork contingent who will sing about it from the rafters if they get any chance to big up Cork. So nah, it's great. It's a great place to go. We've had mixed memories over there in the years, but always incredibly welcoming. So I'd say off the back of the performances over the last couple of weeks, I think there's, you know, no reason why that attendance barrier can't be broken again this week in Musgrave.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point actually you made there about kind of bringing the show on the road. And there are arguments for and against it, obviously. Mm. You know, for years, Donnybrook was the base and it kind of had that bit of identity to it. Yeah. And for a couple of years, Musgrave Park was the base, but they've started bringing it around the country a little bit. We had the RDS last year. We've had games up in Belfast and Cork and back down in Cork again this weekend. And it does, when you're trying to grow the game, it is important to kind of bring that around again and tap in around the country as well. And I would say that the Irish women's team is probably has a much greater representation of people from the wider country than the Irish men's team would have, for example.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you have girls all over. You have the Munster girls get absolutely hyped to be back down, bringing you back down to Cork or just in Munster in general. As soon as you cross the border into the province, they get so excited. The same for the Ulster girls when you head up to Belfast. There's pride in it amongst the girls, but there's also pride in the places, not only the stadium that get to host us, but the actual place and the county that get to host us when we come there. And you really do feel that. I think the women's game, yeah, as you said, it's probably that player pool is so diverse with people from all over, which is lovely, that it gets to tap into those areas. And it just makes it that bit more accessible for people to get to. I think that's important if you want to keep growing it and keep touching the different spots around the country.
It really is interesting to see what happens just in the next 12, 18 months. Because I remember Emily Lane said it in a press conference a few weeks ago. The exact, she was asked about Ilona Maher's impact on rugby just off the back of the sevens in the Olympics and her kind of TikTok fame, but she kind of said women's rugby is having a moment is the phrase that she said. And you do get the feeling that, like, with the amount of tickets that have already been sold for the World Cup in England, that a big year in 2025 from an Irish point of view, you like by 2035 you could really really see what the impact that has is.
That's the thing, like we spoke about, I think last week, about how, you know, Ireland's chance to, and when we hosted the World Cup, we didn't quite capitalise on it with the structures in place thereafter to have the knock-on effect. The World Cup itself didn't go to plan. But I think we can, as you said there, we can make an equally big gain from England hosting it because those matches are so accessible. Like, I know probably 3/4 of the girls I know have bought tickets for a cohort of games because it is so accessible to get over and back that you're able to go to such a plethora of random games. So, like, that accessibility is only going to benefit us, that it's going to be in the public eye. You know, you got the time difference is going to suit in our favor, that they're going to be, hopefully we're sending over a women's team that are going to do serious damage over there. So there's that excitement of actually having those tangible things that you can get excited about of support. I think, 2035, when you look down there, if we keep capitalizing on these little wins and rolling with it and making the most of every single inch that comes our way, I think, the sky's the limit. It's exciting to see where we'll be in 10 years' time.
So looking at the game this weekend then.
Yes.
England, heavy odds on to win a seventh Six Nations in a row. The only time they didn't win a Grand Slam was 2020 in that period where there wasn't really a Grand Slam to win because the tournament didn't get completed. The last three games against Ireland, 88-10, 48-0, 69-0. They have 105 points and conceded 17 in the championship in two games so far. What's the bar this week for Ireland? Like, how do you go about setting that?
Great stats and great memories there of those last three games that you mentioned. Yeah, I think this year in particular, I think there's probably, you can feel that excitement brewing a little bit more. Like, you are going into it as underdogs, no doubt about it. Every man, woman, child knows that. But we talked about it. It's those things that you can get after. I think having watched the second half against them last week against Italy, you saw that you can cause them frustration and you can cause them to kind of ruffle their feathers a little bit and cause them to become a bit stagnant and not able to break you down in the way that they want to play. I think then you counteract that with John Mitchell coming in. He's really kind of had the evolution of England over the last couple of years in the sense that he wants them to let the hand break off. He doesn't want them scoring mall tries and having this boring kind of boring. I say that as a forward, you know, it's great when you're scoring them, but, you know, for in terms of the public eye, he's having them scoring all different types of tries. And we talked about it last week, they can go around you, they can go through you, they can go over the top of you, they can score in many ways. So they are a very hard team due to the way that he's kind of coached them and brought them up to play against and to kind of prepare for. In terms of Ireland, what the gains or what the go-afters would be for Ireland, it's that defensive performance, I think, is key in the first part. I think the girls will know and will be looking to get that full 80-minute performance of a good defensive picture, that no tries are coming cheaply through the middle. We spoke about Italy finding us a bit porous through the middle at times last week around the 10s, that releasing on a tackle and going again or just sniping a little bit. That definitely is an area they'll get after, so making themselves very difficult to break down. The shape that England play means you have to be connected right out until the 60th defender in order to shut down that wall that's coming through you at a speed. And you got to slow down the ruck. You can't let the likes of Mo Hunt, who you imagine would be their starting nine, but they're floating around so much with different personnel. You can't let her have gold ball. They have to have slow ball if you're to have any chance of stopping their flow. So you want to make the flow as difficult as possible for them. On the opposite side of the execution, it's something over the last few years being involved in teams playing against England. They suffocate you with the pressure and you become flatter and flatter and you become probably more desperate to snatch onto the little opportunities you get that you end up kind of making a, you know, a mess of them a lot of the time. And, you know, you score, you shouted those score lines there that we've had against them. Yeah, a few points here and there, but nothing compared to what you'd want to be scoring against an opposition. So for the girls, like they showed against Italy last week, the execution is going to have to be up there. They will get chances. You saw Italy, you will get chances against them, but we have to take the chances that we get. You know, enter into 22, you have to be executing and making the right choices there, whether it's picking and going, whether it's a crossfield kick. You know, you have to be on it in terms of a collective to make the advantages in those areas. After that, then, yeah, I suppose it's frustrating them for as long as possible. You know, a couple of years ago, we did it for 40 minutes against them, but they have that ability to sucker punch you. So you really have to do it. And we saw it with Wales as well. Little patches where you can kind of get in, you switch off for a second, or, you know, they'll sucker punch you right back. So, yeah, that's kind of the main bits, I think.
And, like, in terms of the actual specifics then, maybe if I was to bring you back to playing France last year and playing England last year.
Yeah.
Just when you were talking about, like, the kind of tangible things Ireland can go after. For example, would Scott Beaman have been saying to ye, would there have been specific targets in mind of, we'll say, like, forget about the scoreline, wherever, but as in, from an Irish point of view, we want to hit X number of line breaks. We want to have a tackle success rate that is above X percent. We want a line out return that's above X percent. Or is it more, is it a bit more vague around, they want to see a shape, they want to see patterns, they want to see X, Y, and Z, rather than...
Yeah, I suppose it is specific. I definitely wouldn't say it's vague. It's probably your set piece, like the forwards would shout their numbers and have, you know, obviously they've been in the 90% now for line out the last two games. Here's your ultimate test now. Can you mix it amongst the heavy hitters? Like in England, they did against France. There's no reason why the girls can't do it against England as well. But yeah, it's keeping those percentages high. So the stuff that's gone well for them in the first two games, that's the bar. The girls won't want to fall off that in scrum and in line-out. And over the last number of years, the scrum is somewhere the girls have really gone on the front rows have felt that they could get at England in terms of the little, you know, those minute details of what the loose head prop is doing or the way Sarah Byrne binds, all these little minute details. It will go down to those kind of minute details for position specific things as a game as a whole. Yeah, I am, like, Scott's message last year was very much, let's fire shots and see what we can get, and you're trying to play in your patterns and play in your shape with that. So there'll be that element of they'll be trying to stick to their patterns, stick to their way of playing. I'm sure they will have some form of a game plan up their sleeve to give different pictures. At the end of the day, the World Cup is approaching, and, you know, John Mitchell talked about, you know, refining combinations and systems in preparation for the World Cup. I don't quite think that the Irish team will have that kind of future goal in place, but you'll probably hear it being talked about in a broader capacity. So yeah, I think it's a funny one, because the last number of years when I've been involved in playing against England, we've always played them in the second to last match, and they always go, you kind of have an idea of who they're going to pick in terms of doing your preview, because they always lock and load it in preparation for the crunch against the French or wherever it might be that they're playing them. But with that, you always kind of know who you're playing, whereas the last two matches, we're now playing England third. You've watched them swap all but two players from a starting 15, I think it was, in their first two matches. So in terms of your, when you draw it up on the notice board and you kind of meet with the leadership team to talk, you literally are using the knowledge that the Prem girls have of playing against these players week in and week out, to all the little details of the players. But plus it's England, you have probably three sheets of that in terms of personnel of who it possibly could be before teams are named. So yeah, it leaves a lot of food for thought with the week ahead for sure.
Like, this kind of comes across as maybe a silly question, but like, what is the difference between England and pretty much the rest. Is it the sophistication of their shape and the tactics they play, their structures, the various set piece strikes they have, or is it down to the athleticism and power they have compared to everyone else because of the head start they've had training full time? Like how much of it comes down to like rugby IQ, or you know, the coaching and the patterns, as I said, or is it just the sheer skill level and time on the pitch they've had?
This is the thing. I think you hit the nail on the head there in terms of the time frame. They are the mark of a team, and when you're in it against them, they are the mark of the team who are all singing off the same hymn sheet, no matter what 15 they put out, and they are the mark of a team who've been doing this about 5 years longer than everybody else has. It's the speed and the power at which they, and the athleticism in which they can play. We're all doing the same thing in the last number of years. Yes, the gym programs have been the same, but they've been doing, that whole group of them have been doing it for another 5 years on top of you. So it is a scramble for everybody to try. And even compared to when you play France, you feel it to the same extent, but not to the same extent when you play England. And when I say that, it's that sheer power and speed of which everything is being done. Their fitness levels, their strength, and the sheer size of them. Over the last couple of years, when we've been in pre-England week, and it's the only time, well, it's not the only time, we probably did it a couple of times in Irish camp, that we've brought like under 20s teams to play against us, of boys or men's under 20s teams, if you want to put it that way, purely for the power effect. So we've done line-out sessions against them. We've done scrum sessions of full tilt mauls, full tilt scrums against them to feel the power and to feel the size. Same for, we've had the sevens men's teams come in and play against us in terms of shape and open play. For that picture of like, the rucks are live, tackles mightn't be live, but the rucks are live. How quickly can you fold to match England passing from the ruck and passing, you know, 20 meters that way and killing your first 40 defenders if you haven't spread out wild enough around the fold? So those little things, is it's the sheer speed, I think, of what you'd say is what they do it at. Yeah, it's definitely what you mentioned. I think the biggest part, no, they've not got a better rugby IQ than us, but they have been doing it longer than us in the program that they're in. So they are ahead of us in terms of their IQ on that level, but it is more of a kind of a sheer size thing at times, for their ability to kind of, I suppose, wear you down a little bit in certain aspects of the game.
Yeah. So, I mean, like from a player's point of view, when you would have been looking back at their lineouts, you're not going, God, I'm struggling to read what's even going on here. You know, they're so far ahead in terms of the planning and everything. It's just the sheer size and power. And kind
a lot of it is that accuracy. Like you said there, yeah, it's that because like a lineout, you can execute a lineout against them. It's just, you know, being on the money with where you insert yourself on a defensive maul. Yes, you could do it, but if you put your head the wrong side in a defensive maul, all of a sudden they found the soft center that maybe other teams wouldn't find because you'd survive. They'll probably punish you quicker than other teams will. So we talked about those line breaks that Italy made last week up through the middle, and Ireland scrambled really, really well. You do that against England, they're probably going to score off about two out of the three of them if you do that. Mm. That's the kind of the difference. So no, they're not as a better rugby players necessarily than us, but they've just been at it a bit longer in that system and in that program. It just shows you, as I said, we talked about them being the trendsetters for it, the bar standard setting of changing the women's game in terms of that professional program. And yeah, we'll get there with it. And again, I'm excited to see how close the gap can be closed this weekend. And I'm sure England are definitely sitting up a bit more based on Ireland's recent performances.
Yeah, absolutely. And we kind of spoke about it last week and the legacy that the Red Roses have and how they're pulling everyone up to their level with what they've done over the last few years. But in line with that, like to talk about Scott, when he was appointed, for example, like how much, as a playing group at the time, how much weight would you have put on the fact that he had been involved with that team for so long? Was there almost an instant kind of credibility there that, this guy has been coaching with the standard bearers of women's rugby for whatever 8 or 9 years.
Yeah, 100%.
He obviously knows what he's talking about here.
Literally, yeah, 100%. That was definitely the overriding thought, that this fella knows what he's at, basically, because something that had been incredibly lacking. Obviously, we spoke about it. We were lacking the personnel in the right places in terms of coaches. But what was severely lacking that the likes of you guys probably wouldn't see was the likes of the preview and review and the detail that you could go into and the detail that you knew you needed, but that wasn't happening and you were left to kind of do it yourselves, largely in some areas. So that level of detail, even last year, coming up to like the England, he knew everything. Like, he knew all of them. Not that it made a difference on the scoreline, but like, yeah, it's like, it sounds great, and then you're like, you got beaten out the gate. But
they knew him as well. So that's where
definitely it adds an edge for both. It definitely, I think, you know, it's one that, you know, no more than if you go somewhere new, you want to be able to put one back on where you've come from, kind of thing, of getting a one up. Like, and he definitely, from his ego perspective, I'm sure, wants to be able to put in a hell of a lot better performance and get things right this time around this year. And the girls be the same. Like, as I said, the love is not lost for England, so that bit is never lacking. It's just about getting the detail on the pitch, that bit more refined, and being able to match them for longer. And I think the way the girls are playing and the style they're playing, with the confidence as well, the confidence and the cohesiveness in the group should hopefully make for a good game.
The from your experiences playing under them last season, and from what you might have heard from various teammates as well, what are his strengths as a coach? Like, is he a details man? Yeah. Is he man management? Is, you know, what's the cocktail of things that brings him together?
Yeah, I think he's like definitely more of a details man. He's very specific in certain things that he wants. So definitely the detail side of things. I think it's like more than just him, to be honest, like the overriding thing. Yes, he's details driven and hard to read him. Hard to think what he's thinking at times, for sure. I think I'm the only one that feels that. But I think, to be honest, the overriding thing that brings confidence amongst the group and brings that kind of composure amongst the group is having the other coaches in there. Knowing that you have a coach that they're specifically for defense and only defense that you can go to with your clips, that's not one person trying to do it all, is just night and day. It just is ridiculous. Line out a forwards coach that can do both, that you have a forwards coach for lineouts, that you have a forwards coach for scrums, that you have all those aspects, that you have your S&C, you have your nutritionist, you have all the cogs there. It just, that's the bit that makes Scott better. And that's kind of the honest part of it, like, as much as not going to blow smoke up him, but the other pieces make it kind of the whole picture.
Yeah, so like there's like, it's kind of happened bit by bit over the last 12 months, but you can see that they have built the pieces around. Like, Dennis has been there a couple of years now. Yeah. Hugh Hogan and Alex Codling came in as well. Mm-hmm. Garrett Steenson was there for a little while and is now more involved this year as well. So there's, it's building depth in a team and building depth in a coaching ticket as well.
Yeah, good people in the right positions, which is great. So it's good.
As you said last week and said earlier on as well, England kind of traditionally have started to go all in from round four to build up for La Crunch. But like, from an Irish point of view, Ireland, they've got games against Wales and Scotland away from home over the next 2 weeks as well. How do you see, team news will be announced Thursday. Do you see much kind of rotation in there?
I don't really, because I don't fully think, like, I remember last year I started in the first game and was rotated back out and then was rotated back in again for the England game. And there wasn't much, like, I don't think he'd put anyone in for, like, you're not going to see, I don't think anyone in for a first cap or anything like that. I don't think there'd be that baptism of fire for such a kind of a big fixture in terms of the physicality and the kind of the tempo that's played at. I don't know. Like, it is such a guessing game with them, and he would be, you talked about man management there. He would like a little element of kind of
keep you on your toes.
Keep you on your toes and keep you guessing. So, you know, sometimes you have the usual, like, and we would do it as well. Sometimes you would see the coloured bibs that people were wearing in the info shots or whatever it would be, and you'd be guessing who's the possibles and who's the probables. But you don't really have that element. I'd say I can see it staying quite similar to what it was. I think the likes of, you know, you're looking at your back row, second row, I can see the likes of Dorothy Wall coming back in there from a point of view of a physicality point of view and her experience of playing against these girls now for the last year. You know, the back row then, it's anyone's guess as to who he goes with there. But he's talked a lot about Molly Scuffle McCabe as well in terms of nine, but also the two nines have gone really well. So it's hard to know. Does he twist a lot and use it as likewise a chance for looking at combinations and systems? I don't think so. I think he'll be more of a kind of momentum man. So yeah, I don't see a lot of change. But again, having been on the other side of that, I will hold my peace on that.
I'll rephrase it then, actually. So if there are going to be changes, would you expect them to be largely sticking with that same 23 at the very least? That if there are going to be changes, it could be a Dorothy Wall coming in for someone rather than mixing up that 20, because he's stuck with that 23 two games in a row.
Yeah.
Maybe, we'll find out later in the week. Maybe Bevan Parsons is tracking a little bit better towards coming back or something like that. But
who do you drop? Yeah, it's tricky. It's definitely tricky to see. I would see it probably staying largely within that 23. But again, I say that with horror thoughts in my head of having been on the wrong side of it. So I can't really give you an impartial on that one.
One other element on the selection as well is the 6-2 split. Went 6-2, obviously the first two games.
Yeah.
That in itself has always carried a little bit of risk reward.
Yeah.
When you're playing against England, does it carry a bit more risk than reward?
I don't think so, in the sense that maybe 2 years ago, a year ago, yes. But I think when you look at the players that you have, if you've like an Aaron King, if you've an Eve Higgins, you've all the sevens girls who really can shuffle around to play anywhere.
Yeah.
Like,
good point, actually.
That probably negates it. Like those girls, they're used to having seven on the pitch. So you put 15 on and they're in having a great time because there's so many to cover the space. So I think if it wasn't for the influx of those girls and being able to just kind of flow, you have a bit of wiggle room. But it is still a risk, you know. And Yabrine obviously has found herself on the bench the last two games because she's one of those. She's a bit like who is she? Would you compare her to on the men's? She's able to cover, you know, she's able to cover 10 and able to cover centers. So she's
Jamie Osborne.
Jamie Osborne, yes. She's a bit like Jamie Osborne, like well able to start and you'd back her to start, but also she's found herself in that kind of covering all positions. But yeah, it's not as much of a risk as you kind of think it would be with the girls in there, I think, from the sevens background.
As we come to the end then, I suppose I asked you what would be the bar this weekend, but in terms of predictions, what do you think is the realistic outcome?
Yeah, I think from
or,
a realistic
or the very, what's the positive outcome to head to Wales with next week?
I think, yeah, the positive outcome, I think, would be in terms of defence, they will want to frustrate the hell out of them. They'll want to slow their ball right down and make England make those errors deviate from the norms, from their systems. They will, on attack, want to execute. You get the chances. It's what you do with them. So in terms of the outcome of a successful outcome, they'll go into it thinking they can crack a shot at it. This is the same team that beat New Zealand a couple of months ago. They beat the world champion. So they will feel like they can give it a crack. And why not? Everyone loves an Irish underdog. So from that point of view, I'd be optimistic about it. I think a successful outcome will be feeling like they stayed in it for the 80 minutes. No drop-off comes. And, you know, staying within touching distance. If they can take their points, take their scores when they come and frustrate, then, yeah, I suppose staying, I think a successful outcome, to cut it short, staying within touching distance of them would be what I would say.
Mm-hmm. And firing a few shots as well, I suppose.
Yeah.
Hannah, it's been brilliant as always. Good luck on Sunday, by the way, as well. Blackrock,
yes.
AIL semi-final.
Sunday, Blackrock down at Limerick against UL Bows. So I know you'll be rooting for us in Blackrock, Neil. So thanks for your well wishes.
what's the bar going up against UL Bows then?
Well, we're taking the underdog tag because we've lost to them in the regular league twice. So we will happily go in as the underdog and hopefully ruffle a few feathers down in Limerick on Sunday. That's the plan. So looking forward to it anyway. So,
all right. Well, very best of luck with that. A reminder, Ireland against England in the Women's Six Nations Saturday from 4 p.m. on RT2 and RT Player. And there'll be a live blog on the RT website and live commentary on Saturday Sport as well on RT Radio 1. France against Wales is also live on Saturday afternoon from 12:35 on RT Player. And then in the Champions Cup, Leinster and Glasgow Warriors in the Champions Cup Friday night from 7:35 p.m. on RT2 as well. And live commentary on RT Radio 1. We'll speak to you again soon.